This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today, Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
If you love listening to podcasts, why not take part in our current survey and share your thoughts? It only takes 5 minutes and you could win one of 7 £100 Voucher Express gift cards. To access the survey, just click on the link in the episode description. Please note, the prize draw is open to UK residents only. Full T's and C's are available in the survey link and it will be available until 11:59pm on Sunday the 16th of May 2021. This is Disasters and Triumphs, a new podcast brought to you by Olive Magazine. I'm Janine, deputy editor and host of the podcast, and in this series I'm inviting some of our favourite people from the food world to share pivotal moments in their careers. I'll be asking about first steps, inspiring people they met on the way, and what it felt like when success arrived. We also explore the flip side of that and talk about tougher times that knocked them off course, how they got back on track, and what they learned as a result. Because sometimes failure can be just as inspiring as success. This episode, we welcome Zoe Ajonyo, chef, author, and culinary consultant to the podcast. After cooking up her famous peanut stew to sell at Hackney Wicked Festival back in 2010, she started a monthly supper club at home to help fund her way through creative writing MA at Goldsmiths. Street food, catering, and pop-up restaurants as Zoe's Ghana Kitchen followed in London, Berlin, and New York. And in 2017, she published her first cookbook of the same name. In 2020, Zoe co-founded Black Book, a global representation platform for Black and non-white people working within the hospitality and food media. This year, her cookbook, Zoe's Ghana Kitchen, has just been reprinted, and her new podcast series, Cooking Up Consciousness, is launching very soon. Welcome, Zoe.
Hello, Janine. Thank you for having me.
It's also the second time you've been on the podcast. You first came on in 2017 to talk about your book, and I listened to it again yesterday. God, going back to 2017, those heady days when we actually sat in a room together. And it's a great listen, loads more detail on the book, Ghanaian cooking, and some great stories of you visiting your family back in Ghana. So if anyone wants to go and find it, check it out. It's episode 51. Normally kick off by asking what the pivotal moment was when you knew you wanted to work in food. And interestingly enough, when I got in touch with you to ask you about doing the podcast, you said, I didn't choose food, it chose me. So can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, well, the truth is I was fighting this as hard as I could for a number of years, actually. I mean, the story of Hackney Wicked, how this all started, is well told, but I'll try and keep it brief. I basically got back from traveling around the States in 2010. I was freelance whatever I was then. I think I was doing, I was a freelance copywriter, and I was also a freelance video producer for an air sports company. I've had so many weird jobs. Anyway, I had a lovely time, and I came back broke because it was such a great time. And, you know, Hackney Wicked was going on here. It doesn't exist anymore, but it used to be this big open arts festival. And Hackney Wick at the time was, you know, a super vibrant creative place that nobody came to. It was an industrial estate full of, you know, artists and writers and stuff. And it was the weekend. So the whole point of Hackney Wicked is it's an open arts festival weekend. So my studio, where I'm sitting now, my flat, my home, was being used as a video gallery, basically. And at that point, there was no furniture. There was no nothing. It was a literal white cube. And, you know, all these people were descending on Hackney Wick, but there were no bars or cafes or anything. So I thought, oh, here's an opportunity to make some money. So that's what I did. I tried to make some money with a pot of peanut butter stew, which is what launched the business. But at the time, you know, I had zero interest in, even though there was a lot of people wanting me, even off the back of that first event, which was a runaway sellout success, much to my surprise. People were wanting for that event to happen again, but it was another year before I did it again. And then even then, I was still hesitant, and I was starting my MA at Goldsmiths. And I basically used the supper clubs at my house to finance my way, to support myself through the masters. And even then, at the end of the masters at Goldsmiths, I was trying to escape to Berlin. But I thought, oh, I'm in Berlin, I might as well cook to make some money. So I took a residency in Neukölln at the Werkstatt der Kulturen in Hermannplatz or thereabouts. And then, you know, lots of German press had descended on my kitchen in Berlin, and suddenly, you know, it was just went crazy really quickly. And so it was the universe that made, you know, just wouldn't let it go, essentially. So it was more that the universe brought it to me rather than in terms of a business. But obviously I've always cooked, and I've definitely, since I was knee high to a grasshopper, always been interested in and cooking whatever Ghanaian ingredients I could get my hands on.
So it was a gradual, the universe knocking on your door saying, hi,
yeah,
it's me again.
It became a bit of a standing joke because, you know, I kept saying I'm moving to Berlin, but I'd be back every 2 weeks to cater an event or do a supper club or be at a festival or something. And I think it was around 2013 I finally decided to come back from Berlin, you know. And I mean, it was a gift at the time. I had the best years of my life. I was reading and writing and cooking. That's all I was doing. And it was bliss. It was literally my dream life. But just because, you know, it had grown, Ghana Kitchen had started to get a name for itself. It was being blogged about. It was in the press quite a lot. And I just had to think, okay, what is going on here? Like, this is obviously a business. Why does it need to exist? Like, what's the problem that it's trying to solve, or the universe wants it to solve? And, the edit at the time was bring African food to the masses. And of course, I had to translate it all in really easy, consumable language. But the real mission was always about opening people's hearts and minds to a conversation about culture and race and identity and the politics of food, because, you know, my whole existence really is brimming with politics and, you know, injustice and social justice have always been causes dear to my heart. And food became this vehicle to introduce people to those conversations.
Was there anyone, you know, in your career, say from when you said 2013, when you started properly doing it as a business, to now, who was a particularly inspiring or a mentor to you, or someone that you kind of felt like really helped you on your way?
Now, when I think about who were important and inspiring people in my journey, specifically in food, you know, I was looking mostly to the States, I suppose, because, as I said, nobody was really doing contemporary West African food in London or the UK at the time. I think the only people I can reference who were and of a similar nature to me back then were Eat Jollof, which were a catering company, a very good catering company. But they weren't in the same kind of space as I was, and they weren't quite doing it in the way that I wanted to. But in terms of who can I think of? Oh, so sorry, the States. So, you know, people like Bryant Terry, like Afro that book, Afro-Vegan, was hugely inspiring. Jessica Harris, High on the Hog, and all of her work around food and explaining the relationship between Africa and African ingredients and Black food in America. There's two standout people there. I mean, I guess at the time I probably thought of Marcus Samuelson as a bit of a potential inspiration. Ironically, some people might be surprised to hear Jamie Oliver. When I decided that this was a business, I wrote my business plan on the fag packet, you know, after a supper club with a cigar hanging out my mouth. That's who I was then. And me and my friend Yasser Khan, who also designed the look and feel of the brand back then, we were writing like, well, what could it be? And I said, well, everything that Jamie Oliver's got, why couldn't I do that for African cuisine? So there was nobody directly in my field of vision who was feeding me anything, but I was certainly getting inspired by what other people had done with food. And when it came to writing my book, I mean, Sabrina Gale's Persiana was a very strong reference point for me as well in terms of the look and feel of it and the tone for the book. So, yeah, there's been definitely various people who I've picked influences from along the way, but no direct mentor, so to speak. And the few people that I did reach out to, whose names I won't share here, because that might be embarrassing for them, you know, didn't ever respond or reply or had the time. And, you know, I understand we're all, as an entrepreneur, you know, I understand how busy we can get. So yeah, I was running under my own steam thereabouts pretty much, but that was a good place to be because I was out of that space of comparison, which obviously is the fear of all joy.
Yeah.
The death knell of joy, isn't it? Comparison. So in that space, I might have not had direct mentors, but I certainly had guides and reference points in terms of what the brand could be.
I was going to say, because of your, you know, good and bad experiences in reaching out to people and getting some help, and then in other cases not getting any help, has it become more important for you to be a person that someone up and coming Absolutely, can come to and yeah. ask and be kind of be that mentor, be that inspiration?
Exactly. I mean, that was quite a lot of the inspiration for Black Book, which also is born out of my experiences in America, where there is just such a wider Black and POC convergence in food, and just more resources and better support networks, but also spaces that celebrate the Black voices in food, and also platforms the questions. And when I should mention some platforms rather than just saying what they do. So spaces like Black Food Folks, Radical Exchange, Resistance Served, She Chef, Just Call Me Chef. There's so many. But and then also the queer spaces like Queer Soup Night and things like that. There was just so many more spaces aggregated for people who were other than white to be represented and network and have a voice. And I wanted to bring some of that to the UK because it was sorely, sorely missing. But I wasn't able to do that until, ironically, the pandemic killed my catering business and freed up my time.
I was going to ask you about, and this is probably going to be a hard one, about success and the concept of success and what it means for you, because obviously you've got so many different levels going on. What is success for you?
It's been a journey, honestly, because when I started in this food game, success for me was being able to write, read and make money cooking food. I was having a very successful few years. Then the cookbook came out and suddenly success looked a little bit different for me because I was in a really different environment. I was kind of in the industry now, and that meant that, well, it didn't mean anything, but where I was at the time, I kind of fell into this trap of comparison and feeling like I needed to compete in that space with other, do you know what I mean? And there's no one else to blame for that. It's just the environment of, and also where I was in my head at the time, I suppose. But, you know, in I've opened Brixton and I put myself under a lot of stress and pressure, saying yes to everything that was coming my way, because I felt like that's what I needed to do to be successful, right? And then I had a massive burnout in 2019. And following that, I had space and time to reflect on success and where I was in my career and what I wanted to do. And, you know, was I fulfilling the purpose? Was Garner Kitchen fulfilling the purpose that it was set out to do? And I realized that it wasn't, actually, you know, and I'd gone off in all these myriad directions, chasing success. So success now for me is very much, and I'm not saying that I've nailed it on the head, but I try to view success in the moment that I'm in, you know, very literally. So success changes almost every day. You know, I don't try to have grand ideas anymore about what success is and looks like. Success for me is if I'm happy, if I'm feeding myself, if I can pay my rent, if I can pay my bills, if I'm able to, if my work in some way inspires somebody or helps somebody or guides somebody. And I do a lot of coaching and like free mentoring and stuff like that on the side. And I love doing that because, you know, as I've already said, there wasn't anybody there to help me when I was asking people for that support. So when people ask me, I really do try to make the time to respond and give them as much of me as I can without having to charge them. So, you know, it's, and I love that. So that success for me now is like having, building a legacy where I guess it's, you know, my ultimate success in 5 years' time would be having a nice farm to table concept that's West African under the Sankofa moniker, and, you know, chilling out, reading and writing again, you know, and then cooking on the side.
Stick around for more inspirational chat, stories and advice from Zoe. And on the flip side of success, this podcast is called Disasters and Triumphs. Would you be able to share an obstacle or a disaster, something that a difficult time you faced?
When I review the last 10, 12 years of being in the food industry, and then when I review even before that, the last 30 years of being in the working world, you know, whatever was a failure or didn't go very well ultimately was a transformative moment, you know, because I bang on about this a lot, actually. But, you know, it's when you're down in the weeds is where the growth happens. You know, it's getting through the pain points where you learn, and without learning, you don't grow. So whatever they were, and there were millions of them, you know, I'm here today because I survived them. But yeah, I think it's the really big one was being in hospital in 2019 for 10 days in intensive care and not even seeing it coming, you know, and just realizing that, you know, I'd been really abusing my body and my health emotionally, mentally. I was really depressed, actually, in 2018 and 19. I had two difficult years there financially. And, you know, I'm sure you know this, but I'm in recovery. And, you know, I was drinking a lot back then and relying on other things to, you know, get me through whatever the stresses were. But yeah, being in hospital, I think in 2019, that really just floored me and made me have to just reevaluate everything that I was doing and how I was doing it and who I'd become, because I didn't even recognize myself anymore, really.
Wow. What were you in hospital for? What was the diagnosis?
Yeah, well, they thought I had meningitis. It was basically, it was the back of, I just got back from the last festival of the season.
Yeah.
which was it was a really good one, actually. It was the one, it was our best one of the year that year. But what was happening was I was short of staff and I was driving back and forth every day to wherever that festival was, which is somewhere in Northamptonshire or something, I don't know, somewhere. It's like 4 hours outside of London. So, but I was working in between, right, at the pitch. So I was basically awake for 20 hours every day, and not eating properly and, you know, drinking beer for breakfast as you do at festivals sometimes. And then, you know, driving with no sleep and what, anyway, basically they thought I had meningitis and I got rushed to hospital and da 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 da. And a lot of tests later, like lumbar punctures and x-rays and all manner of tests were done on me and they couldn't figure it out. But ultimately it was just that my immune system had pretty much collapsed and just was like, I can't do anything else. You just have to just lie down for 10 days, basically. But as I say, it was a huge gift because that 10 days is like, wow, what is happening? Like, how did you get here? You know, and I had to think about lots of things. I had to think about who I was as a leader. Like, why hadn't I managed to create a team by that point who could have helped take some of the burden? Why wasn't I vulnerable enough to ask for help? Why had I, you know, why was I so undercapitalized still 10 years later after I started that business, which I bootstrapped? Why wasn't I feeding myself? You know, why wasn't I exercising properly? I was really fit in one sense of the word, but, you know, I was really, because I, you know, and I still can carry 20 kilos of Calagas over my shoulder, which most men can't. I'm very strong. So, you know, but, so as I say, that was, yeah, that hit me hard because it not just on my personal health, but also just like it fanned out into all the other parts of my life that came under review. And, you know, and like not seeing my niece for nearly, I've missed all of her growing up all that time and family time and friends. They all just gave me perspective and made me want to do things differently in 2020.
If you were going to go back and give any advice to Zoe Mark One in, say, I don't know, 2010-11, what advice would that be?
Get some help. Don't do this on your own, you mad bitch. Yeah, to 2010-11 Zoe, I would say actually, and here's the thing, because I had lots of help in 2010 and 2011, actually. It's not like I didn't have help. Like, all my friends were working as waiters and waitresses and help. You know, they were all so supportive in those first couple of years. I think what maybe I would say to myself then is build a team strategically, you know, like you can't do it on your own and you need to build a team that you can trust and who know more than you. That was the other problem, you know. I was always hiring people who weren't qualified enough for what I needed them to do because I never had the capital to hire somebody who knew more than me. So it was always kind of on the back foot constantly and my time was always consumed with teaching rather than letting anybody flourish and what they were good at, and I just didn't have the infrastructure. So I think getting the right team from very, very early on. I mean, I relied a lot, probably too much, on friends, and what I needed to do was build a team. So I think, yeah, I would say to that, you know, just trust people and be vulnerable and ask for help when you need it, and build a good team around you of people who you respect and love, and be kind.
I asked you for a recipe that you make when you want to kind of soothe and comfort yourself, and you took us back to the beginning.
So ground nuts stew or soup is, in my house growing up, it was called peanut butter stew, and that was it. It was and is delicious. So it's basically, and it can be vegan, I will say that, but traditionally in our home growing up, it was always made with mutton on the bone, or lamb on the bone, So you get all that beautiful marrow and collagen and flavour going into it. And then it's like this, it's just an amazing balance of spice, savoury, sweet. It's piquant. The smell is incredible. It's so comforting to eat. It's like, I've said this time and time again, but there's so much comfort in eating it. It feels like you're literally being hugged every time. And I can't eat it fast enough. Even now when I'm eating, I just filmed a thing with my mum actually for an online platform. And at the end they were like, I'll taste it. And I couldn't stop eating it once I started tasting it. It's just a really, really incredible dish. Obviously filled with nostalgia for me because it's so integral to my childhood memories of food and my early relationship with Ghanaian food. But it is just a treasure trove of delicious. It's just amazing, you know.
Have you adapted it much since you, I mean, because obviously you said you used to make it growing up with your mum. Have you adapted the recipe from when you first started making it?
Do you know what? I think I've probably got about 10 or 12 good versions of it now, vegan and otherwise. Like there's versions where I like roast the bones before I make the stock, or I make, with different kinds of vegetables, with different kinds of peanut butter, like, or like cashew butter or almond butter, or but it's, you know, I mean, me and my mum talked about this again because we were just filming it the other day. The truth is it doesn't matter how fancy I try to make it, the principle is just the same, really. It's like one pot of and that's why I love it as well, just because it's so accessible and such an easy recipe. But you just put everything still into a pot at the end of the day, you know, and just the longer you cook it, the more delicious it will be. The next day it will be better again. And the third day, if you've still got any left, it would be great then too.
I love that though. And it is it's kind of a taste of home. And it's, as you said, it's really accessible. And when we talked on the last podcast about your book, there's so much of it in there which will take you on a little journey, but there's lots of great starting points that people can get involved with it. The book's out now, isn't it? The reprint of
Zoe's Ghana Kitchen is available now to buy.
And I think everyone should go and buy it because it's a beautiful book.
Thank still. You so much. Yeah, I mean, I hope so, because that's what I did want from it, you know. I didn't want it to be I think people think it's a weird thing to say, but I almost wanted it to be a coffee table book. Like, of course I wanted people to use it to cook from, but I just wanted it to be an inspiration mainly, and like a reference, a tool, like a resource to access Ghana, you know. It's like, just make it as easy as possible for people who aren't familiar with it to get some, to dip their toes in, I suppose, and for people who were familiar with it to just understand a bit more detail about the ingredients, and also how to cook it themselves. Because, you know, the other thing about this kind of indigenous cuisine is like it's handed down orally, like the recipes are sort of imbibed, or in the same way that, you know, nobody taught me how to cook it. I had to stand next to my dad and watch and observe. It wasn't like a taught lesson. And I think that's a lot of experience, because the matriarchs hold, you know, the recipes have been told, given orally or just by osmosis, you know. So I think I got so many emails when the book came out the first time around from Ghanaians around the world saying thank you. Even for recipes like corned beef stew, which definitely only latchkey Ghanaian kids had for dinner. But people were really happy to see it there, because it's like, yes, I grew up eating that same thing as well after school. And that brings me a lot of joy.
Yeah. Is book number two on the cards, or are you not allowed to tell us? Or
God, you'd think so, wouldn't you, by now? But
yeah, I would.
I have put a treatment out there for a work which is it is a cookbook, but it's more of a collection of other people's recipes more than it is a collection of my own recipes. And you know, it's just not really about me anymore, Janine. I'm trying to platform other people and give other people a stage to stand on, and just still you know, I'm passionate always and will ever be about Africa, not just Ghana and West Africa, but all things Africa, and giving the chefs from that continent, whether they're in the diaspora or still in the continent themselves, a much needed spotlight, because we're still got a long way to go. I mean, I noticed a couple of Dueva and Michael Alegbi and Selassie. I think those three chefs made it into the world's top 50 or top 100 chefs, whatever those lists are that circulate around, which is great to see. But there's many more, you know, who just don't have the profile that they deserve, really. And I want to help.
Where's the best place for people to connect with you so they can find out what you're doing, what you're working on? I guess there's always ghanakitchen.com is a good space on your website.
Yeah, ghanakitchen.com, which is now an online single origin spice store from West Africa. We're going to be introducing some grains and other bits and pieces very, very soon. Or at Ghana Kitchen on Instagram, or at Zoe Adjonya on Instagram, if you can tolerate my sweary mouth. I swear a lot. Oh,
well, you've managed to hold
my podcast coming out in mid-May, Cooking Up Consciousness, which is also a Clubhouse. If anybody's on Clubhouse, please follow Cooking Up Consciousness.
I'm going to go and investigate that. That'll be available on all popular podcast platforms. Thank you so much for coming to chat to us today. I'm aware that we've run over time as well, so I'm going to say goodbye and just thanks again, Zoe, and really good luck with everything that you've got coming up.
Hey, listen, thank you so much for having me, and always a pleasure to work with Olive, all things Olive. So yeah, thanks very much for having me back.
You've been listening to Disasters and Triumphs, an Olive Magazine podcast series. To find out more about the series, including the recipes we talk about in each episode, visit olivemagazine.com, where you'll also find our huge back catalogue of over 200 podcast episodes. Don't forget to subscribe at Acast, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to never miss an episode.